You are listening to Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast, series 3, episode number 3 for Thursday, February the 2nd, 2023. JJ Sefton once again, and I am joined by my father, colleague, and good friend, CBD, somewhere in the wilds of the Democratic People's Republic of New Jersey. CBD, how you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. Finally, winter is coming. It was in the low 20s this morning, and tomorrow it's going to drop into the single digits, which I know that a lot of people dislike winter, but I really do enjoy it quite a bit. My snowblower is sitting in the garage, lonely, ready to go, but with no work to be done. So hopefully we'll get, you know, a nice 15 or 20 inch snowfall before spring arrives, and I'll be able to take it out and show the neighborhood its paces. I know I sound like a lunatic, but I really do enjoy doing it. It's usually quiet. I do it early in the morning or late at night. It's a pleasure to do. All right, I'll stop ranting like a lunatic. Anyway,
you may have our winters if you want it. I don't necessarily mind it. I just mind when it's 3 degrees below zero for the high without a wind chill. That's kind of annoying in my house with some insulation problems. But we'll deal with that as the spring arrives. And hopefully, I think Punxsutawney Phil saw his shadow, or maybe he saw the shadow of Bill Debolshevik and he ran the other way. Didn't want to get killed. But
if you dislike the wilds of Wisconsin so much, you can come back to New York and you can live in one of these Midtown hotels or Upper West Side hotels with the other illegal immigrants. And you can, throw rocks at journalists, which, by the way, doesn't bother me at all. But
but we digress.
Yes.
Anyway, speaking of throwing rocks at journalists, which they actually do, and I use the word journalist loosely here, these are mostly propagandists. Last week, as many, or unless you've been living under a rock somewhere, there was a horrendous situation in the city of Memphis, Tennessee, where a gentleman by the name of, I believe his name is Tyree Nichols, who is black, was beaten to death by 5 Memphis police officers, which was all caught on camera. And these officers are black. But here's the situation. So you have 5 black police officers, a black suspect. I believe the mayor of Memphis is black. The police commissioner is black. The DA may also be black. And Memphis, from what I understand, is 63% a black city. And yet the problem here, of course, it's white supremacy. It's America is a racist society, and the specter of slavery once again rearing its ugly head. How they square that circle is just the most insane thing. But this is what we have, and then journalists are pushing this meme. And of course, once again, that wonderful human being Al Sharpton is on the news proclaiming that this is indeed a problem of white supremacy. But some interesting twists to this, which may never get reported thanks to the journalists, but it's a horrendous situation. It's just, it's unbelievable the depths of what our political, don't even know what to call them, rivals, or not even rivals, but the powers that be will stoop to in order to divide and conquer this country and to tear us apart for their own personal gain, of course.
And it is their own personal gain. This is obviously a naked vote grab. They're trying to continue the politics of division in the United States, something that as recently as 20 years ago seemed to be, sort of a quaint artifact of our history. I lived in California, in Northern California, for a long time, and I saw that race relations were not perfect, but certainly far, far better than they were when I was a kid, even a teenager in New York in the 70s. But once again, this is the politics of division, and the media has gotten the message loud and clear that they have to push race into every single story. I'm not sure how he pronounced his name, but Mr. Nichols was beaten to death, not because of white supremacy, but because of the ridiculous state of policing in America. I wrote about this on Ace of Spades a few days ago, and I will continue to write about this. We have a huge problem in America with the pathetically bad state of our policing, and it has nothing to do with race. The symptoms, it might seem like that it is racial, but the reality is that our police do not know how to do their jobs anymore. What was it? 4 or 5 policemen could not control 140-pound man. I find that ridiculous. Absent the murder, they should have been thrown off the police force simply because they were lousy cops. Ignoring the murder, which is awful enough, they did not know how to do their jobs. And as you mentioned, that there are, you know, there are rumors of other things. There was some personal relationship between Nichols and one or two of the cops. Apparently, a couple of the cops might actually be current members of a gang in Memphis. It just gets worse and worse and worse. And this can be laid solidly, firmly at the hands of the Democrat Party apparatus, who see police as a necessary evil, and they want to subjugate them and turn them into a tool of you got it, you know, racial division. And they've succeeded.
Well, this current round of it started, of course, nearly three years ago, with the death of this gentleman, George Floyd, up in Minneapolis. And so the at least several dozen American cities went up in flames because now it was Officer Derek Chauvin, a model police officer. Probably not. Maybe not. I don't know. I don't know what the standards are for hiring up in Minneapolis. But it supposedly he had his knee on the neck of George Floyd. And as it turned out, that was not the case. He had his knee on him. But George Floyd had died of a number of things. He was chronically ill with either COPD or a lung disease. And plus, he had managed to, I believe, swallow his stash of crystal meth so the cops wouldn't find him and be subject to a third strike rule and be sent up the river. So what happened in the wake of that, you had this defund the police movement. The police somehow were now being painted as death squads out to get and kill innocent black males. And so that was the cry that went up all over the country. And so when police saw the writing on the wall, they just decided this is not worth it for me. And many of them retired. And many more people who wanted to perhaps be police officers said, I'm not going to become a police officer if this is the attitude. If nobody has my back and I can be subject to murder charges just for doing my job, competently, incompetently, or whatever, then this is what happens. You reach the point where cities have to scrape the bottom of the barrel to get anybody to put on a uniform. Worse, they will just get people who, without even any sort of vetting whatsoever, and put them in uniform. And this is exactly, as you said, CBD, what possibly happened in Memphis. For sure, they were incompetent, and they may have actually been, you know, members of criminal gangs. And so this is what happens. And by the way, it's not at all necessarily something that the powers that be, you know, really, you know, mind at all, because look what happens with Antifa and BLM. When people protest legitimately against the government, BLM and Antifa are used as the sort of the stormtroopers of the government. And when the stormtroopers put a beatdown on you, sort of with a nod and a wink approval of the government, after that, the DOJ and the FBI go after you for, you know, I don't know, kneeling and praying in front of an abortion clinic or protesting critical race theory in your school or transsexualism and transgenderism. So it's two fists, one with the bully boys and the beatdown. And the other one, the official junta going after you for political persecution. But again, it's all part and parcel of divide and conquer, and however they can do it. Now, that said, we've had this discussion before about police abuse and how, you know, it's a two-edged sword. And the corruption in police departments, even before all of these things, where basically they were kind of just sort of interested in, you know, in protecting their pensions and doing things that normally would be abhorrent, such as the enforcement of ridiculous COVID lockdown regulations, like in New York, when the police went after the Hasidic community for having to hold prayer meetings in the, you know, services in secret. And this is something that really was kind of annoying. So on the one hand, you sort of feel for the police, but on the second token, you sort of go, well, damn it, if they're just going to be tools of the government just to sort of to cover their own asses, so to speak, then, you know, it's kind of hard to feel sorry for them. It's a horrible situation.
You mentioned, well, you didn't mention it, but I'm going to mention it now. This is, okay. You know, this is the creation of division in society based on race. And you go back 100 years ago, 120 years ago, and you discover that class warfare was an important part of a political movement called communism, socialism. There is nothing out of the ordinary about using these divisions to foment a cultural and societal crisis. And that is exactly what is happening. And the purpose is clear and the antecedents are clear. This is socialism at work. This is communism at work. This is progressivism at work. And it's working. They know what they're doing. The playbook was written a long, long time ago, and it's a good playbook, and they're using it well.
you know, there was an interesting article, and sort of going off on a little bit of a tangent, but I think not really. There was an interesting article in Front Page Mag, and a couple of them actually on the same theme, but one of them was about the situation in Europe, where you have this mass Muslim immigration into European cities, and how in a very short time, these cities are going to become majority Muslim. And basically the fact that Western civilization and Islamic civilization are antithetical to each other, and they cannot coexist because Islam wants to conquer the civilizations in which adherence to Muhammad may be living. And so the author made a very interesting comment, saying that at least in the United States, you know, over the course of however many years, we have a common society and a common system where, you know, we can overcome, you know, issues of Jim Crow and racism and so on and so forth, and where blacks and whites can actually relatively live in peace, if not in total harmony. And I have to just laugh at the cluelessness of that, given the situation that's going on, not with the Tyree Nichols, just with Tyree Nicholas or Nichols, but everything that we've witnessed over the last however many years, going back to Trayvon Martin, if not before. But it raises an interesting point in that, you know, you talk about socialism and communism and Islam, and it's basically two sides of the same coin. One civilization, our civilization, the values that we hold, Judeo-Christianity, Western civilization, the Enlightenment, the American Revolution, so on and so forth, cannot coexist with people who just do not respect that. And so the same thing with Islam. They cannot live by the laws of our society. So so what they try to do is they try to overturn those laws. So what's insidious about socialism is, and what happened in this country, is that here we had we're far from perfect, and we know we're far from perfect, but over the last however many years before all of this, we were sort of finally, you know, getting to a point where it was live and let live, and all of these sort of issues were in the past. But these people are actually literally creating a pseudo-Islamic society for the purpose of subjugating us, we the people, who will not bend to their will. It's kind of an interesting and frightening perverse parallel, if you will.
Well, it's even worse than that, because we did have a taste of a post-racial society. And for the Democrat apparatus, for the progressive apparatus to actively push for a post race-blind society really is nauseating. We're returning to separate but unequal. In fact, if you look at academia, it's fast approaching the point at which white men will vanish from our campuses. White women aren't too far behind, unless they are non-binary or trans women. But it really all goes back to the politics of division. And until we return to the idea of a melting pot, until we return to the idea that America is, you know, out of many, there is one, we will continue to be tortured by these unbelievably damaging and so, you know, society crushing issues.
And that was it's funny. And all of this really came to a head, I think, with the election of Barack Obama, who supposedly was supposed to be this post-racial president. And he was, you know, sea levels falling and all this kind of garbage. But beyond that, I knew so many people that I used to respect as intelligent, you know, thoughtful people, who I was trying to warn them against voting for this guy who was a socialist and all the things about his background with Frank Marshall Davis and so on and so forth. And the only thing that they can come back at me with was really voting for him only because, well, he's black. And if we vote for him, then we'll actually put racism behind us. And that's, I think we should have a black man as president, finally, regardless of his background. I'm thinking, well, if you're going to vote for a black man, why don't you vote for Clarence Thomas, for crying out loud? But that's another story. And so when you have that kind of an attitude, it's you know, you're banging your head against the wall. But then again, look what happened after Barack Obama was elected. Racism went back 50 years, 100 years, and it's crazy, and it's topsy-turvy, because it's all the people who are, you know, who are now benefiting from this are now literally they're the ones wearing the Klan hoods. There's no difference if in the rhetoric of people like Ibram Kendi to Al Sharpton to this Nicole Hannah-Jones to Van Jones to you name it. It's if you just juxtapose a few words here and there, there's no difference to what they're saying than what Adolf Hitler said in Mein Kampf or what the Klan say all the time about black people going back 100 years. It's the irony is just insane. And here it is, people claiming that white America is founded on racism. It's a racist society that will never get over the stain of slavery, and that black people can never get ahead. And we elected a black guy twice, and we have Oprah Winfrey, who was a multi-billionaire and the richest woman in America, both of whom are black. Well, it can only be one of three things. One, they're stupid, and they're flunkies, and they're working for the white man. Number two, worse, they're consciously working for the white man to keep their fellow blacks down. Or three, this whole thing about white supremacy in America as an illegitimate racist society is a crock of shit. Well, of course, it's number three. But you go tell that to the people who are claiming that five black cops beating up and killing a black man in a predominantly black city is white supremacy. Then there's no logic. You can't debate it. So it's, you know, crazy.
Well, their logic is insane, but it's internally inconsistent. But what they are suggesting is that the structural white supremacy has tainted even black cops. Now, it simply does not make any sense to me. You know, a black cop sees a black perp and he beats him to death. Black perp, who the hell knows what this guy did? As far as I know, he drove erratically. Whether that's true or not, I have no idea. I'm not exactly sure how that works, that structural white supremacy drove these black cops to behave as white supremacists instead of just large variety thugs and murderers.
But
I mean,
well, look at this way. Even if you tried, if they would even allow this, even if you tried to have an actual empirical structured debate with somebody like Ibram X. Kendi, who I call Ibram X. Crement, but that's another story. But even if you tried to have a debate with someone who puts forth this cockamamie crazy theory, it's again, you're arguing with a crazy person. And that's, what do they say of that? You should never argue with a crazy person, because then it's pointless. And they will parse words, and at the end of the day, they'll just scream at you that you're a racist and you just don't get it.
This whole situation, and I think I've mentioned this on Ace of Spades, and I might even have mentioned it on our last podcast, is that if those cops had been white, Nichols would be alive.
And oh, absolutely.
I'm not sure how that meshes with white supremacy, but I'm sure somebody can explain it to me. Let's move on to another topic. We've got a couple. We're going to try to keep this one fairly short, but we've got a couple that are interesting. I know that Ace of Spades wrote about Donald Trump's attack on Ron DeSantis yesterday, and his point being that Trump is no longer ascendant, that the push, the internal, the quiet, the private push among conservatives in America is to push Trump aside and move on to very possibly Ron DeSantis, or who knows who else is coming down the pike, Youngkin possibly. Anyway, I mostly agreed with Ace. I'm tired of Trump's histrionics. I'm tired of Trump's attacking those who are essentially, I mean, DeSantis and Trump are essentially the same people, the same person. Their politics are similar. Their ability to poke at the media is quite similar. Unfortunately for Donald Trump, DeSantis is younger. He's more vibrant. I think he's brighter, and he has a more impressive record of dealing with the difficulties of being a successful executive, a political executive.
Let me sort of play devil's advocate a little bit here, or at least throw this
please
out.
Please do. Please do.
Okay. And it's not that I'm supporting Donald Trump or not supporting Donald Trump, because I think we've discussed over the several podcasts with our usual co-bloggers, and of course with Michael Walsh, who is eminently fervently anti-Trump to run again in an election in a primary season. isn't it not, you know, forgetting the personalities involved? I mean, is Donald Trump, how is Donald Trump supposed to, shall we say, oppose Ron DeSantis and vice versa in seeking the nomination of the party? I mean, yes, personally sliming him. I know Donald Trump was you know, world famous for, was it Lion Ted and little Marco Rubio, and had all these little aphorisms and names and nicknames. Names of the Afro people, but the fact of the matter is they stuck, whether legitimately or not. Again, as I used to have a boss who, when somebody annoyed him on the phone, or he didn't want to take a call from someone that annoyed him, and pardon my French, he would say, tell the jerk to go fuck himself, but in the nicest possible way. my question is, how does Donald Trump supposed to tell Ron DeSantis and vice versa to go fuck himself in the nicest possible way when trying to win the nomination of a, you know, of his party? And I get it. It's like, you know, it is friendly fire. But again, the Democrats do this to each other as well. But I guess the Democrats get away with it because they have the media on their side. But the differentiators. How do you differentiate yourself when you know this is what it's all about?
That's a very good question, and I don't know the answer. But what I do know is that Donald Trump hammering away at Ron DeSantis is not productive. It exposes the divisions within the Republican Party. It exposes the divisions within the conservative wing of the Republican Party, and it absolutely exposes Donald Trump's mania when it comes to this cult of personality that he has built around himself. It's really, really frustrating. Any attack, real or perceived, on Donald Trump is grounds for what is essentially a nuclear attack on his opponents. And the fact is that Ron DeSantis is not his opponent.
Yeah, he's an ally, grand, really.
In the grand scheme of things.
Yes.
Ron DeSantis is going to be around after Donald Trump is dead. Hopefully he will be the president of the United States, or somebody with similar skills will be president of the United States. And what is going on is that he is trying to keep for himself that incredible groundswell of populist / nationalist / patriotic fervor that he was able to create in 2015 and 2016. And if he tries to keep it for himself, he will diminish himself as a politician. If he tries to create a larger movement, one that has the possibility of taking back America from the progressive decay that we are in the midst of, then he will become a statesman. And I just don't think that he has it in him to become a statesman.
I can see your point. I do agree with that to a certain extent. I will say this, just in the last week or so, Trump held a couple of campaign rallies where, if you put the attacks against Ron DeSantis aside, he laid out some amazing red meat in that he said, we're going after the whole transsexual thing and the critical race theory thing, and we're going to take back the schools, essentially. And that is, I think someone mentioned it on one of the websites, and they label it as that this is wall 2.0. It's like, you know, the wall was building the border wall was 2016's big thing, and education is going to be the big thing in 2024. And I guess not to be outdone, and I don't know if it was at the same time or one was reacting to the other, DeSantis has scored some pretty impressive victories against critical race theory, having them removed from the curriculum of the Florida school systems, and I think maybe even the university systems, at least in the public colleges. So all of this, I think it would be nice if this was the attack, if that it's one-upsmanship. It's always hold my beer, but with more red meat, as opposed to attacking each other. Donald Trump says, I'm going after critical race theory. And then Ron DeSantis says, hold my beer. I'm going to fire all the teachers who teach this and decertify them and let Donald Trump, you know, raise the stakes. It's good for two reasons. One, it fires up the base, and number two, it causes a stir in the media, and at least it causes these issues to be brought to the forefront so people can see them and become made aware of them. But I guess, you know, personalities being what they are, and this was kind of a negative. I think Trump attacked DeSantis for his record on the whole Chinese coronavirus thing when it was Donald Trump who basically, you know, let Fauci and Birx and all the rest of them pull him around by the nose and brought us into lockdown hell, which it's 2 weeks to flatten the curve, and we're in like week 150 now, I believe. So that was something that was really, if you're going to blame Trump for anything, that's something that he should have never listened to these people. But of course, you know, it's public health. What are you going to do? And, you know, that's what it is. So we'll see how this plays out. Is it healthy? Is it unhealthy? Who knows? Again, you have the Democrats and the media that are going to beat us up anyway. So what's the diff? But I get your point, though. CBD, did I lose you? I think we lost CBD. Let's try to regroup. J.J. Sefton here with the Cup Jib Newsletter Speaks podcast. We'll be back after we sort out this this technical mesh of goss. Hang in there.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, I hear you now. There you are. Did
yes.
You,
and do you know why you couldn't hear me?
Why?
Because I turned off my mic to take a drink and I forgot to turn it back on because I'm a schmuck. Sorry about okay. that. Anyway, let's take a break, and we will come back with a couple of quick hits, and we will wrap this puppy up.
Absolutely. See you in a minute. Final segment of the Cup Jib Newsletter Speaks podcast, season 3, episode 3, J.J. Sefton with CBD. We're going to go international this time. Seems like there was a major uptick in violence in the state of Israel, terrorist acts and so on and so forth. And of course, a lot of this is linked to the situation which is going on in Iran. So I know we had at least There was one that happened on Holocaust Remembrance Day, of course. So that was the irony, is that they want to remember the Holocaust by starting another one, which is funny because they claim the Holocaust never happened, and yet this is what they're itching for. But the violence is ramping up in Israel, and a lot of that is being cheered on by such wonderful places as the New York Times and in our own State Department, of course, because this behooves them, because to put the pressure on Israel to get back to the bargaining table with Iran to get this crazy nuclear deal. So it's damned if you do, damned if you don't. But dangerous situation happening.
It absolutely is. Last week there was a terrorist attack in Jerusalem at a synagogue, and 7 people were murdered by this maniac, by a Palestinian Arab or an Arab from East Jerusalem. And one of the issues is, well, actually the initial issue is that the Arab terrorists are getting a little bit better at smuggling weapons into Israel and making these attacks. But the larger issue, I think, is that Israel is on the same road as America, and that is that we have tried to control the rules of engagement to such an extent that our enemies no longer believe that they have lost. And Israel is going down the same road. I think it's incumbent upon the state of Israel to take the gloves off and push back hard against this Arab terrorism. And because until the Palestinians, who are considered refugees by the United Nations and by most of Europe, which is insanity because they are refugees simply because they were told by their leaders to leave. At any rate, these refugee camps are essentially cities. But until they are beaten badly by Israeli military might and taught over and over and over again that they have lost, that there is no military method by which they can succeed, this is going to continue, and it's going to go on for years and years and years.
Well, this is why you had, by the way, the when you talk about the wars that Israel have had, the legitimate wars with the Arab states from 48 to 56, 67, 73, and so on. They could never beat Israel militarily. That's the thing. And so what they tried to do was beat them politically and in the culture. And this is why we have the BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which thankfully a lot of people and a lot of institutions are pushing back against. And that is ultimately a very good thing. But you're right, CBD. I think there has to be – the gloves have to come off. And I think the situation in the Middle East now between – thanks to Biden and also thanks to Donald Trump in a positive way with the Abraham Accords, which have opened up a rapprochement with much of the Arab world, such as the Saudis, the Emiratis, and so on and so forth, to have relations with the state of Israel because of their common enemy and their common major threat, which is Iran across the Gulf there. This might make it easier in a way for Israel possibly to do things that maybe even 10 years ago they could not have even considered. And I hate to be brutal, but let's be brutal. drive the damn Arabs back into the sea and retake the Gaza, retake the damn West Bank and kick them out. Because I think even the Saudis are sick of having the Palestinians be this sort of political football that or political tool that has been used to beat up Israel. And now they don't necessarily need the Palestinians anymore because they see that, you know, the big threat, as I said, is coming from Iran. And Israel is in more ways not just an enemy of an enemy, but possibly little by little becoming a friend. The irony here is that Jordan, which has a peace deal with Israel, it's the coldest peace out there, probably next to Egypt, and they're actually on the road to becoming another enemy of the state of Israel. So maybe this calculus is with what's going on with Iran is and what's going on with the other Arab states who are tired of the Palestinians' antics as well, could let Israel take the gloves off. Of course, the big fly in the ointment there is we have the most anti-Israeli administration in America since Barack Obama, or arguably it's a continuation of the Obama administration, which is anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, and so on and so forth. So we shall see.
Ably supported by their fellow travelers at the New York Times, which has been rabid in its attacks on Israel and Jews in the over the last month or so, ever since Netanyahu was reelected as prime minister of Israel.
The New York Times despises him,
even though he's, in the United States, he would be considered a liberal Republican, possibly.
But but they identify him with Donald Trump. So there you go. They have a close relationship, and just the fact that I don't think he may be a liberal Republican, but he's not like a real leftist. And I'm not really an expert on Israeli politics, but there are some in Israel that are literally almost as insanely suicidal as the American Jews here of the Democrat Party variety that want to sell Israel down the drain and themselves down the drain here and sell America down the drain as well. So,
oh, absolutely.
You know, it's insanity. So they see Netanyahu as perhaps a harbinger, if not of the coming of Trump, which I know you're averse to, but at least the harbinger of Trumpism returning to the White House, which means fiscal sanity and foreign policy sanity once again, where we don't let the crazies just run rampant and start wars all over the place. So
crazies running rampant and starting wars all over the place, I wrote about a retired British general who is talking about boots on the ground, NATO boots on the ground in Ukraine. And I find that offensive in so many ways. The idea that NATO is going to expand its own borders, North Atlantic Treaty Organization is going to expand into Eastern Europe and expand what is a regional war, which is a border war, a border dispute between two countries, into what is very, very possibly going to be a world war. Now, if that does happen and NATO mobilizes and puts boots on the ground in Ukraine, how is Russia going to react? Militarily, it will lose. However, Russia has a large and presumably functioning nuclear deterrent, and I cannot see Vladimir Putin simply giving up and pulling out of Ukraine in the face of NATO expansionism.
He will be forced to push the button. That is a real red line, as we had said. I think it was maybe Dave in Florida, and we mentioned it on the last podcast, is that the Russians aren't pissed off at Putin for invading Ukraine. They're pissed off at Putin for not literally smashing the shit out of Ukraine and literally dropping the hammer. They want him to take the gloves off and take Ukraine, whether it's the Crimea or the eastern part of the country or the whole enchilada, so to speak. So if NATO all of a sudden puts boots on the ground and we're there, the pressure will be on him, and he'll have to almost certainly use some kind of a nuclear weapon, whether it's tactical or, you know, God forbid, bad enough, or God forbid, an ICBM landing somewhere. I don't know that it would hit the West or hit a Western capital, but certainly Kiev would be flattened, and who knows what else. And then, of course, it's all bets are off. And of course, once NATO boots are on the ground in Ukraine, that'll be a signal automatically for Xi Jinping to sail the straits across the Taiwan Straits there and invade Taiwan. And there'll be nothing and not a damn thing we can do about it. You can only pray that the Taiwanese army can hold off the Chinese. So it is World War III on both these fronts. But, you know, it's just the insanity should not be forgotten, by the way. Whatever the situation between Ukraine historically and Russia over the hundreds of years, perhaps, whatever that might be, The current situation evolved from the fact that we guaranteed Ukraine's territorial integrity if they gave up the nuclear weapons that used to be based on their territory after the collapse of the Soviet Union. We made all these guarantees to them, and we told the Russians that we would not expand NATO, we would not do any of these things. And what did we do? We expanded NATO, or we've been pushing to expand NATO. So what do you think the Russians are going to do? They're going to get ticked off at us. And in this instance, rightly so. Does it, you know, justify invading a country and causing all kinds of hell on earth for the Ukrainians? No, it doesn't. But at least you have to understand the calculus and what got us to this position that started in 1994 when Bill Clinton, you know, did what he did with them and so on and so forth. And then from Foggy Bottom, administration after administration, just basically poking the Russian bear and saying, we're going to do whatever the hell we want. Well, surprise, surprise. This is now what we have. We have potential for a nuclear exchange in Ukraine. This is, it's unbelievable. And thanks to them. Thanks to just the incompetence all over the place and the hubris, because we won the Cold War. And instead of winning the Cold War and really trying to win a peace with Russia, we decided to poke them in the eye for the ensuing, you know, 20 years hence. So here we are.
Yes, here we are. And, you know, I mentioned it in the last podcast that if the tables were turned and Russia were expanding into Mexico or Costa Rica or, you know, who the hell knows, northern Canada, we would go insane. We would lose our minds, and rightfully so. And I'm not trying to justify Putin and Russia's expansionist tendencies. It's axiomatic. Putin is a very bad man. Okay, fine. But as you pointed out, why did we have to poke the bear? There is absolutely no reason for it. Yeah. Anyway,
by the way, you mentioned, if what would happen if a foreign power, if the Russians went into Mexico and invaded there or took over, you know, whatever part of Mexico they were going to, or Central America. Well, it turns out Iran is now sending its navy to the Panama Canal. And what are we doing about that? Nothing. I mean, here we are pissed off about Russia and the Ukraine. You know, that is the situation is. And we want to put boots on the ground there. Well, at the same token, the Iranians, and by the way, the Iranians are very, very, very close with the regime in Venezuela with Nicolas Maduro. And there are military bases and military operatives and intelligence and terrorist cells that are no doubt training and working in Venezuela even as we speak. And now their navy is moving into the Panama Canal to have maneuvers. And we're doing nothing. We're just sort of ho-hum, nothing to see here, folks. Let's ignore the whole situation. And by the way, we also have an open border where who knows who is coming into our country at the same time. It's not all Mexicans looking to sort of, you know, pick grapes in the fields of Ernest and Julio Gallo. Among them, I'm sure, are quite a few terrorist cells that are looking to kill us if they have half the chance. But of course, we have to save the brave Vladimir Zelensky, that wonderful Churchillian character. It's sickening, really, and maddening at the same time.
I'm not particularly worried about the Iranian Navy in the South Atlantic. In the grand scheme of things, that's simply them trying to show off that they can actually cross the ocean. What I am very, very concerned with is what you were discussing, is that is the open border and the ability of Iran to send terrorists across our southern border, essentially unmolested. Have they done it? Probably. Are they going to act in the United States? Very, very possibly. I don't know. And neither does anyone else. And that's the sad thing about it. With an open border, the inability to know what is going to happen next is obvious. And it can't be a very, very good thing. Venezuela is also another interesting point. Why we allowed Venezuela to devolve into this dystopian progressive hellhole while we are, you know, furious about Russia going into Ukraine. I mean, it's an irrational foreign policy. It makes no sense in the grand scheme of things for American safety, for American security. And yet we're going to see more and more of this as Biden descends more and more into dementia. And by the way, who's running the White House nowadays?
Well, Ron Klain is out. He jumped ship.
So who's up next?
Well, it's, well, Kamala, is she going to, I mean, nobody likes her either. So who knows what the hell is going on? It's crazy. I mean, now we get into whole realms of, who's going to be running in 2024. I mean, it looks like, obviously the obvious thing is they're trying to get Biden the hell out of there for whatever reasons they want to get him out of there. But who is going to be the one to pick up the mantle? Is it going to be Gavin Newsom? I don't know. He's a white, he's male, and he's heterosexual. Is it Kamala? Nobody likes Kamala Harris. And there was talk about this Wes Moore character, who is the governor of, not Maryland. I forgot what state he's the governor. Maybe it's West Virginia he's the governor of. I'm not sure. Supposedly he's, as Joe Biden would say, he's clean, articulate, and he can talk jive when he wants to. So, I mean, but make no mistake, if you're a Democrat and you're being groomed for the top slot, you are every bit a Marxist-Leninist as Barack Obama is or any of these people are. So it's bad news throughout whoever it's going to be. But I don't know. That's the whole thing. We don't know who's running the show. And what kind of a signal does that send to the world? Friend and foe alike. I mean, it's we're descending into a crazy season here. And then on top of it, we're talking about putting boots on the ground in Ukraine and going toe to toe with the Russians.
Going back to the Democrat nominee in 2024, I mean, you named a couple of people and we can laugh about that. But the issue is not who they choose. The issue is whether the vote is going to be merely an afterthought. I've played around with the Electoral College map. And as far as I can tell, there is only one pathway for a Republican win in 2024, and that is to take Georgia, Virginia, and Wisconsin. I think everything else is baked into the cake as a Democrat victory. And I'm talking about Nevada, Arizona, Michigan, Pennsylvania.
And that's because of all
single pathway to victory for a Republican candidate in 2024. And that scares the shit out of me.
Well, look at Arizona.
I don't think we can take Wisconsin. It's possibly Georgia, possibly Virginia. Whether Donald Trump can carry Georgia is a good question. I think that Ron DeSantis can carry Georgia.
Right. It's just, well, then again, we're talking about, it goes back to the whole, election, quote unquote, rigging, not rigging, thievery, non-thievery of ballot harvesting, mail-in ballots, unclean voter rolls, who's counting, who's not counting. And, all of this nonsense, which, we can talk till we're blue in the face about all these things about who's going to win and who's going to be the candidate. But when you have six states and four or however many different swing districts that the Democrats control the vote and how the vote is counted and collected and so on and so forth, it's pissing into the wind. I don't know. I mean, I hate to be a downer about that, but somehow that's got to be stopped. And I don't know how you're going to stop it unless you have the will to do it. And the Democrat machine is going to give up the machine, which I don't think it's ever going to do that.
Well, listen, I think that, we're being unnecessarily pessimistic. Rona McDaniel is chair of the Republican National Committee, and she's going to fix this in the next 18 months. I'm not worried at all. And you know something, Donald Trump chose her, so I'm just going to count on the fact that Ronald McDaniel is going to do a good job, right? Folks? That's Donald Trump's choice, Ronald McDaniel.
By the way,
what's
Ronald
her middle
McDaniel
name? What's her maiden name?
Romney.
Anybody remember?
Romney.
Yeah.
Give me an R.
Fantastic. God. All right, folks. Okay. I got to get the hell out of here. We're way, way off the reservation, so... until next time, Mr. Sefton.
Yes, this has been Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast. JJ here. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We really appreciate it. Keep the cards and letters coming. Hit the tip jar, and we will see you again real soon.